The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good evening, everyone. The topic that I chose for today is what inspires me about the Dharma. And since I know that some of you are quite new here, I want to make sure that people know what Dharma is. Dharma, the most common translation or meaning, is the Buddhist teachings. Less common, it can have the meaning of phenomena, principle, or classificatory category. But definitely I'm using it here as Buddhist teaching. So the purpose that I have set for myself with this talk is hopefully to inspire you, even if it's a little bit, to push a little the boundaries of who you think you are. This is definitely what I saw myself doing as I was putting together this talk. So I want to start by telling you how many, many years ago when I was in my 20s, I was spending a year in Rome, and I had a Benedictine uncle, a monk, who was a monk, living in Rome at the time. So I thought it would be a great idea to go visit him regularly and have a discussion about the Bible, which I had never read before. So I would read some passages, and then I would go, and we would discuss. Unfortunately, very soon it became clear to me that my questioning and challenging was not appreciated. It was actually considered disrespectful to be questioning the Bible. Needless to say, I lost interest and stopped going and stopped reading the Bible. Now, if we jump forward 20-some years, I began coming to Theravada Buddhist groups, and to my delight, I very quickly learned that here you are encouraged to question. Here you are encouraged to be very proactive. And this felt totally right. Whenever a teaching was presented, when I first started coming, and it's still done, of course, I was encouraged to go and try it out, not just say, okay, I'm supposed to do this. This is what the teacher says is supposed to be right. So this brings me to the role of the teacher that felt also very right to me. In this tradition, we are constantly reminded that the teacher is another human being with weaknesses just like me, with the difference that the teacher has become more conscious of his weaknesses and therefore is less manipulated by them. So we're constantly reminded not to idealize the teacher, not to follow the teacher blindly. Instead, it is all about experience with a practice, direct experience. The teacher has walked already a good stretch on the path that practitioners are just starting on. Therefore, the teacher can make suggestions and inspire us to overcome the inevitable challenges that we encounter in the path. So I like to think about these talks as a way of coming together, learning together, questioning together. So in this spirit, I offer the talk. So now I want to talk about something I have found profoundly inspiring, and I'd like to call it the inner ecology. I like this term because this word, if we translate it literally from the Greek, the ECO part means house, and the logi, with logia, means, of course, study. So I like to think that this is a practice that we're studying, we are investigating what is happening in our inner home. It was a great discovery for me when I learned that there were teachings to help me to work with a mind, with my mind, that caused me so much suffering. When I was getting my bachelor's in flute performance, I would spend approximately 6 hours a day by myself studying, practicing in a study. There were times where I would blissfully play along for hours on end, but there were other times where, out of the blue, very challenging thoughts would arise, totally uninvited, and I didn't have the foggiest idea how to deal with them. These thoughts were tremendously criticizing. I would criticize myself mercilessly. So what a gift it was when I began to learn to apply mindfulness to the mind and became aware of this tyrannical voice. I really wish I had known about it when I was 20. So through the practice of mindfulness, of our mind states, of our thoughts, I have become skilled at noticing when this critical voice begins to form. Now I can see sooner, I can catch it sooner when these judgmental thoughts begin. So when we catch them, when they're just beginning, they're like small weeds that have small roots that you can easily pull out. However, if we don't catch them in time, these dark thoughts that we don't see, and they begin to get bigger and more strong in our mind, very soon becomes depression. And that gets very difficult to uproot. It's as if these thoughts have had time to grow deep roots. And it's very difficult to stop that. So with time, as the practice grows, it allows us to care for our inner ecological system. And we learn to protect ourselves from ourselves. Part of developing a healthy inner ecology system is to develop enough tranquility to see clearly of what's going on. It can be quite fascinating when we can see, hopefully with some detachment, how sometimes something in us contracts like a tight fist. Now, when this happens, I know I'm headed towards unskillful behavior. I have practiced to notice this moment of contraction and to realize that I have an option to act out of this contraction or out of spaciousness and wisdom. As I have practiced holding the contracted part of myself, holding, I mean, not criticizing, just being aware of it, I see clearly now the frightened and ever hungry ego that is at play. Little by little, we develop compassion for this ego that we all have inside that is so tremendously needy. The practice of generosity has been very inspiring to me in the Dharma. I was intrigued when I learned that in Buddhism we talk about three different kinds of generosity. The beggarly giving, the friendly giving, and the queenly or kingly giving. I can say that as a small child, I was a pro at the beggarly giving. If I think especially when I was little in relation to my sister, I would be offering her the dessert I didn't like or the old wrinkled stickers that, looked pretty terrible. So beggarly giving is when we give with hesitation and only give that which we don't want ourselves. So then the friendly giving. Here we learn to give freely what is of use to us. And here the title, I think, explains it quite well, so it describes it. So friendly, meaning it's typical that we want to give a friend, that we want to be generous with a dear friend, and we want to share something that is of value to us. But now let's come to the queenly giving. I was lucky to experience this several times as a teenager hiking in the Sierras in Mexico and arriving to these dwellings in the middle of nowhere after I'd been hiking for days. These were very, very poor people. And these people barely had enough to eat, yet a total stranger, they would offer their meager meal. They would sit down, invite me and share a plate of beans and rice and a few tortillas. This is the queenly giving. This is the perfection of generosity. When we offer the best we have, without hesitation and with great joy, without expecting anything back. So presently, I can say I don't have much to give as far as material gifts, but I'm making it a practice to give my family and friends my time and attention. That is another kind of generosity. My Christmas present to each family member was a one-day trip to whatever place they found interesting. I'm also finding great delight in offering my time and the practice, which is what I value most, to my fellow Spanish-speaking practitioners as I teach here every week. I find that the more I deepen into this practice, I am more able to be spontaneous and laugh about my contractions and insecurities. And I think that's quite a gift. In my experience, people with long time and deep practice are able to take typical mishaps from daily life with humor and spontaneously adapt to the change. So I want to share with you a small breakthrough, a little victory I had some time ago, where I could really see in a very tangible example the benefits of my practice. So a few years ago, I needed to be in Mexico for an important meeting to sign some papers. So A dear friend of mine offered to accompany me, and we made plans to go on this trip. We arrive at the airport. I deliver my documents at the airline counter, and much to my surprise, the person behind the counter says, "I'm sorry, your passport is not valid anymore." So I was explained what my best options were, and as I waited for the person to explain what I could do, I could hear this voice that went, "How could you have..." And I caught myself. So I started to breathe, paid attention to my body, decided to just get whatever information I needed to iron out the practical aspects of how I was going to deal with this, of going to San Francisco and getting an emergency passport and paying a good amount of money for that. So as I rode on the train to San Francisco with my friend, I faced their reality squarely and considered how to make the best out of what was. Yes, I had made a faux pas for sure. It was too bad. But I saw there was no point in punishing myself further. So I started by apologizing to my friend for the inconvenience I was causing him and was very grateful that he was a good sport about it. Out of this mistake and this unexpected turn of events, I thought to myself, why not make a celebratory day out of this? So after taking care of getting my passport, which included quite a few back and forth, we just engaged in having a good time sightseeing. There's so much to see in this endlessly interesting city. We then had a wonderful dinner and stayed over in a very nice hotel. Now the next day, with passport in hand, ready to board the flight to Mexico City, I took a moment to realize that there was pleasure present. Pleasure at seeing this small victory where I had pushed the limits of the way I usually react to things. And realized this, I could thank the practice 100% that I was able to stop myself. Because if we really stop to think about it, what good would it have been to go on punishing myself, criticizing myself for the mistake? Now, the more I have learned to soften the tight fist of how I think things ought to be, the more I find myself laughing at things that before would have sent me spinning into anger or worry. So a couple of weeks ago, I pulled into the parking lot of Trader Joe's, and a very enthusiastic young man came up to me and he said, "I'll fix your dent in your bumper and it won't cost you too much." So I've had this dent in my bumper for about a year. So I said, "Well, okay, go ahead and fix it." So that evening, I was sharing with my friends in my community how wonderful I finally had fixed my car. It didn't, you know, it now looked kind of decent. And the very next morning, one of our dear members in the community, as she was trying to back up, we have a very treacherous driveway, she really gave my car a good scratch. So she came looking for me, very concerned and apologetic. And when I saw the car, I found myself laughing, and I thought, what an irony here, in case I was getting attached to my car being in good shape, here I had a new collection of scratches. So here again, you know, how liberating that one gets to the point where we can laugh about what is, as opposed to getting all bent out of shape. Here is another aspect that I have found quite inspiring, and it might be a little surprising, but it is about discovering what boredom is all about. Boredom is unpleasant for all of us, to be sure. None of us want to feel bored. But I also noticed in my practice that I had a bit of an elevated idea about myself and found that me, bored, no, I'm beyond that. Now, in long retreats, you experience every single mind state that exists in humankind. So, yes, boredom came to visit me too. I wasn't pleased when I became aware of boredom. And it was subtle enough that I could have deluded myself and called it something a bit loftier. Now, in my early retreats, however, it was very obvious. I couldn't have deluded myself. I have a memory in some of my early retreats where I would get to a point where I didn't know what to do with myself. And there was one time where I remember going and sitting in front of the watering system and looking at the water sprinklers and thinking, please entertain me, something. So this is how low we sink during retreat. Or actually, if we really notice, this is really the way it is all the time, except in retreat you notice, and normally you don't. So as you can well imagine, no Las Vegas show happened. The sprinklers just kept doing their regular circular motion, watering. So I figured I might as well investigate what is boredom. So then I realized that boredom is not just one single mind state, but boredom has quite a few components. First of all, is about being distracted. Then there is a certain feeling of dullness in the mind. Ooh, nobody likes this. It just feels like, ugh. And also a feeling of being unsettled. And in general, there's this sense of being dissatisfied of what the moment is like in the present. You wanted it to be different. Now, the body also gives you some information of how it feels to be bored. The body, when you're bored, feels heavy, low energy, and the breathing gets very shallow. So I discovered that boredom in general was disengaging with what is happening in the moment because I found it uninteresting. Now, the next discovery I made was not exactly flattering, and that was that I noticed that as soon as the present situation had something to do with me, my ideas, or my life, then it suddenly became endlessly interesting. So after this sobering discovery, however, I found it very gratifying to begin to fine-tune this mind and body states that were off balance. That is, fine-tuning the alertness, energy, and quietude in the mind in order to perceive with subtlety what is really happening. as I began to manage to find that balance between energy and tranquility, the mind had a different quality. The quality was luminous. And then I discovered that the mind in that state finds the movement of the sprinkler and the reflection of the sunlight in the water beautiful and fascinating. So to end, I want to mention one of the most beautiful qualities, I think, that we practice here. And that is the practice of metta, or loving kindness. This is a friendly, kind, and spacious way of being with our experience, our weaknesses, and that of others. Sharon Salzberg, in her book, A Heart as Wide as the World, tells a story that is very touching of her teacher, Dipa Ma. She recounts how during the 3-month-long retreat at IMS in Massachusetts, there was a man, imagine partaking in a 3-month retreat, so this must have been a pretty serious meditator, but it got into his head that he wanted to go and watch a particular football game on TV while on retreat. So because you have endless amounts of time to think during a retreat, he fathomed a plan how he was going to get out of the retreat, get in his car, drive to a hotel, check in, watch the game, and come back without anybody noticing. Well, he actually did it. He managed. And one would think he would feel very pleased with himself, but he was surprised to find that he was plagued by guilt, especially when he had to come in for his interviews. So the weeks kind of went by, and this guilt started to feel heavier and heavier until he decided he was going to speak to Dipa Ma. So in one of the interviews, he discloses his little excursion. Dipa Ma very quietly took his hand, looked at him in the eyes, and said, "That's all right. Now let's start all over again." So this kind of forgiveness for ourselves is something that I'm learning more and more. And to finish, I would just like to wish us all that we learn to offer this kind of loving, accepting forgiveness to our weaknesses, and also start anew. So I'd like to take a couple minutes of silence to transition into a short discussion where I would love to hear now from you, in whatever stage you are, even if you are quite a beginner, some of the things that have some of the aspects of the practice that have been inspiring for you. Yes. But here comes the microphone.
How has meditation impacted your music making?
Okay, that was a question I wasn't expecting. It's interesting you should ask that question, because I feel that as far as the dance, I have completely integrated my past in the dance world with the practice. And the music is kind of still half there. You know, since I finished the PhD only in 2009, it's still a little recent, and I can feel that there's still some work to be done. One thing, though, that I notice, and I have to say that's not very good news for a musicologist, is that I'm not listening to that much music anymore, a particular kind of music, because I've become very aware of how a lot of music really makes your emotions go on a roller coaster. If you told me this 20 years ago, I would have said, that's crazy. When you study music aesthetics, it's all about how to move the emotions, how to move people. And yes, it's wonderful. We want to be moved. But as you practice more and more, this ups and downs become smaller and more subtle. And you find that happiness is much more subtle and exquisite when you don't go into these huge ups and downs. That makes sense. Now, I should say that after my last long, long retreat, that was six weeks, I made a very conscious, almost ritual, for listening to my first piece of music after the retreat. I went and spent a couple days with a friend of mine who's a musicologist, and we picked Rosalind Turek playing some of the Bach solo piano pieces, and she's just exquisite. And it was just, I must have listened to about 10 minutes, but I was just crying. It just touched me so deeply, and it was incredibly meaningful to me, that listening, more meaningful than maybe years of listening to music. The power was incredible. So I hope I answered the question. Thank you.
How about for those who must practice music, and it's motivation's important. A component of music. So how does meditation relate to motivation?
Okay, as far as the motivation, I'll go to, because there's something that came to my mind that I think it's quite beautiful in relation to music and the practice. In order to really take in music, you have to be in the present. We are so bombarded with stimuli that we don't even... It's music is all over the place. And a lot of really bad music, too. So if you take some time out of your day and don't do anything but just listen to music, it's a form of meditation. Because it's about being present. Music is all about now, now, now. And you make logic by stringing together all these present moments. That's how you make logic of a piece of music. A piece of music has logic. So that's one of the things that I find makes a very beautiful sense and connection. Also the cultivation of joy That's another wonderful quality that music gives and that we cultivate in this practice. Sharing music with other people is a beautiful way of creating a kind of an intimacy, like the kind of intimacy that we create when we spend time in silence with people in retreat. You know, it's that nonverbal communication that is beautiful. So, did I answer the motivation part? Because I wasn't sure where you were going with that.
You know, in practice, you know, one of the difficulties in practicing meditation is when you have chaotic thoughts and you're not unable to calm the mind to concentrate. Well, the same thing happens if you must practice. You have a chaotic mind; it's not going to motivate you to do what you must do. You know, that is to say, doing something you don't want to do but have to do. And that was my motivation for asking the question, how do you do something you don't really, you're not in the mood of doing, but have to do, to just continue the discipline, the practice?
But this is as far as the practice or the music or both?
For me, practicing an instrument and practicing meditation, similar emotions occur. Sometimes you cannot sit down and meditate, and sometimes you cannot sit down and play.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see, you know, it's that kind of applying yourself.
It's just a practical concern.
Right. Right. So maybe I can speak very briefly and because I'd like to hear from others. But with anything that we want to learn, you know, is this aspect of applying ourselves. And I think what I'd like to offer is that one of the biggest gifts that, and also that is very inspiring, when you of mindfulness, when you really internalize mindfulness, is that you see the relation of cause and effect very clearly. And if you see that practicing has these benefits for you, you will do it. You won't sabotage yourself because the mindfulness is telling you so clearly that this is what you want to do, despite the fact that right now you feel a little lazy or whatever, you know, which we all do sometimes. So I hope that answers. Anybody else? You know, it can be little things about the practice that you've discovered. It doesn't have to be huge, dramatic things. And the advantage of, I mean, I know it takes a bit of a resistance of being quiet and having to speak, and even worse with a microphone. But the advantage of speaking, whatever it is, little breakthrough that you've had, is that you will internalize it more. You will clarify it more. It will become more part of your growth. That's what I like to make space for sharing. Yes, thank you.
So I'll loop back and talk about something you talked about a few minutes ago, which is becoming less and less oscillatory in one's emotions and behaviors.
Yeah.
Less. I certainly have felt this several times where I almost felt withdrawn from the world because of my practice, almost inhibited from emotion or even engagement with myself and others around me. Would you like to comment on that? It seems to be, you know, an outcome that can happen.
Yeah, I think that's... that's a slippery slope. We have to be able to differentiate between the desire of not live in this ups and downs that are, you know, all these upheavals that are is they're tempestuous and they cause us suffering, with not with being detached and not caring and being aloof. That's a big difference. We can be, we can have this equanimity or equipoise is very luminous. It sparkles. You're engaged. You're feeling. You're seeing clearly. You're hearing very acutely. You're smelling very acutely. So you're completely engaged. You're being with somebody, and maybe you're not talking very much, but you're really sharing a lot. There's a lot going on. So it might look similarly, but it's very different, very, very different. And I think it's very important that we don't confuse it. Am I being clear? Because I'd love to try to explain it more if it's not clear.
I can understand that what you're trying to say, I think, is that it's not necessary to be outgoing and verbose with one's emotions and still be engaged.
There you go. Exactly. Exactly.
But nonetheless, it seems to me, and certainly I've been practicing for a while now, that sometimes I end up in this place where I am completely disengaged, both from the world around me and myself.
You know,
maybe it's avoidance. It could be.
Well, you know, that's one thing we need to be very careful. You know, that we don't, if we start to feel that we're numbing ourselves, then we have to be very careful. It's because there's a difference of feeling deeply but staying equanimous, or just, you know, not caring, isolating ourselves, and just not feeling. So it's one of those things where we have to be very careful not to confuse. Yeah, it's, you know, we all can misuse the practice, and we have to be careful that we don't. And one of the you know, Gil always has this lovely, simple, direct answers. And one of the things that I've heard him say often is, if what you're doing is leading towards less suffering, to more happiness, then you are on the right path. So it's that question that you can ask yourself when you're not sure. Thank you. Anyone else?
So I'll caveat what I have to say by saying it's hard in this practice to have a goal ahead of you that you're inspired towards.
That what?
That you're inspired towards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something that I see in the future going better because of this practice, considering that, you know, that means I have an attachment to something
that hasn't
happened. I have expectations. And so I'll caveat it by saying it's a little bit paradoxical. But what I like about what I currently experience is less reactivity, more present in the moment, and have that having a really positive impact on my, you know, relationship to the world and to other people, in the sense that, you know, things are smoother when I don't get short-tempered with someone, and I have more patience.
Yeah.
I think there's just, you know, better outcomes and better understanding between me and others when I'm not as reactive. And so I think what really inspires me personally, and this gets to the sort of goal aspect, is that I don't yet have children, but I would like to have children. not too far off in the future. And I hear that they take a lot of patience. And so I take this comfort in the idea that I'm working on myself towards a place where I can set a better example, I can be less reactive and more present with them, hopefully them, in the times when my patience is being tried. So that's sometimes when, when I think about why do I just sit and breathe for 10 minutes, whereas 2 years ago I didn't used to do that. It's partially for what I experience now, and it's partially for this sort of nice idea I have in my head of how it's going to help me improve, hopefully.
Yeah.
Something I'm looking forward to.
Thank you. That's beautiful. And it's to prepare yourself for motherhood. I mean, that's huge. You're planting seeds, very important seeds, a human being or several human beings that can make a big difference in the world. That's very important. Thank you. It's beautiful. Anyone else? Yes, Maureen.
One thing that I'm especially fond of is metta practice. And not just from the idea of wishing well. It's like, thinking, oh, well, may you be safe. Hey, you free from harm. Like these little mental woohoo bullets that you send towards people or situations or creatures that you see, but it improves my vision.
Your what?
My vision. Like my ability to see what's going on around me. It's I can see how that, if I wish you well, it may not do diddly squat to you, but it sure does something to me.
Yeah.
And one of the things it does, it really improves my ability to observe.
That's amazing.
And my ability to catch myself if I'm making myself crazy, if I'm making myself ill at ease. It's like the fact that I sometimes will go and take the time to wish myself or wish somebody else and people I don't know and people I can't stand. Well, I notice more because I'm looking at those categories and I'm wishing, that those things would work out for other people. So it's this really multifaceted kind of practice that turned out. I was skeptical about it in the beginning. I, like a lot of people, the only thing in the beginning that I could really do metta with was my cat. It's like, oh, geez, Louise, I'm going to do this. And it's like, okay, yeah, I really wish my cat well, So that was easy. And then it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I can do this. Cranky ladies in the grocery store. It's like, wow. And I am a whole hell of a lot less cranky since I've remembered that that's a practice. And it's a very robust practice for me.
That's great. I really like very much what you say about how it benefits yourself. Having come from a Catholic background, at the beginning, it was kind of like, I thought it was kind of like a prayer, that you're thinking you're going to get the result out there. It's like, I hope you are going to be well. And then, little by little, you learn, no, it's about here. Again, this ecology here. I mean, how am I feeling inside and inclining the mind towards these beautiful states? So it's practically 9 o'clock. So thank you very much. Be well.